What cities would you visit if you wanted to get a true history of the art that was made during the 20th century? New York, Paris, Berlin. How about Nukus, Uzbekistan? It is home to the world's largest collection of 20th century avant-garde art created during the Soviet era, despite the official censorship that forbade it. How it came to be stored in a desert town in Central Asia is the subject of a documentary by Amanda Pope and Chavdar Gorgiev. It's called The Desert of Forbidden Art, and it opens today at the Cinema Village. I'm very pleased that it brings Ms. Pope and Mr. Gorgiev to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
Hi, Leonard.
Isn't Nukus a rather out-of-the-way place? I said it's in Uzbekistan, but should I have said it's in Karakalpakstan?
Yes, it took me about a year to get used to pronouncing Karakalpakstan. Karakalpakstan is actually an independent republic within Uzbekistan.
But it's not Pakistan.
No. It's right within Uzbekistan, but there it is, a special political entity.
It's kind of like Texas, where Texas is allowed to raise their flag as high as the United States flag.
And how did that happen? That happened after the fall of the Soviet Union, didn't it?
Well, it's very interesting because when Comrade Stalin divided the republics, he divided them in a Roman way, divide and conquer, and he made sure that half of Kazakhstan, the famous Borat movie, is in Uzbekistan so that they can never rise against the authorities. And that became Karakalpakstan.
Is this a difficult place to travel to?
Yeah. Well, yes. It's not without its challenges. Yes, it's remote. You can now fly from Moscow to Nukus in 3 hours. But when we started filming there, you had to go to Tashkent and then fly out and then go by car. It is remote, and its very remoteness is what protected this collection. Actually, it is the second largest collection of avant-garde art next to the Russian State Museum in St. Petersburg.
Although the Russian State Museum wasn't able to show it for much of all the Soviet era, right? But this was already being shown?
It's amazing because the Nukus Museum was the only place in the Soviet Union where forbidden art was on display and it was purchased on government money.
How did you learn about the Savitsky collection?
Well, it's a wonderful story. I was asked in 2000 to go by the Eurasia Foundation, Washington, D.C., to do short portraits of emerging leaders in the former Soviet Union. And at the time, we were to go to 7 countries in 5 weeks. And I didn't really want to go with anybody my own age because I knew they'd complain. So because I teach at the University of Southern California, I thought, I want to go with our recent alums. They'll think it's an adventure. And Chavi had been one of my students, and he spoke fluent Russian, so he was the first choice. And when we were in Uzbekistan at that time, we heard about this collection.
And Russian is the language that people speak, isn't it,
Uzbeki? Well, Uzbekistan is a multinational country, which is a remnant of the Silk Road. You can find all kinds of people there, Koreans, Jews, Indians, Uzbeks, Kazakhs. It's an incredible conglomerate of languages, but the official language was Russian. Now it is Uzbek, and Russian is not as encouraged.
So we have this museum there. You knew about it.
No, it's amazing because nobody in Russia knows about this collection as well as in the West, but some specialists. And when Amanda came to me with her eyes lit up and saying, Chavi, there in the middle of the Karakum Desert, I heard that there's this incredible treasure trove of art. And I said, Amanda, you must have had a little too much to drink last night. This is absolutely impossible. And I was so convincing that we never went to Nukus on that trip.
So this is really all because of the efforts of a man named Igor Savitsky. Mm-hmm. Who was he? Was he an artist?
Well, that's interesting. He was an artist. He was very ambitious, and he wanted to be as great as Malevich or Chagall. And early on in his career, his teacher, who was a man by the name of Falk, criticized some paintings he had done, and he was so hurt that he gave up painting. And because of that, he had to find something else to do. And because he had the eye of an artist, though he had no money, he sort of switched his obsession from painting to rescuing these paintings.
Well, we're talking about forbidden works at the time, weren't they?
Yeah.
Wasn't it dangerous to make them and to collect them when Stalin was in power?
The works that are housed in the Nukus Museum were made in the 20s and 30s.
On the cusp, before it became a punishable offense to paint these kinds of paintings.
In fact, scholars refer to this collection as the twilight of Russian avant-garde art. And Savitsky found out about these paintings purely by accident. He happened to stumble into the home of this of the son of this famous artist, Alexander Volkov, and he said, "Oh, what's that? I've never seen paintings like this. How come nobody knows about them?" And that's how he started collecting.
But in most of the cases, I'd imagine, these were paintings that were being hidden because it was dangerous for anybody to know that you had them.
Exactly. They were rolled up. I mean, literally, they were under people's beds. He found one of them, you know, patching a hole in the roof. And it was a real challenge. He had to be trusted to even see the paintings. But once the widows, and most by the time he was collecting, he started collecting in 1966. The paintings had to go underground around 1932. That's when Stalin came in and the real repression started. And he would find out about this widow. He'd go and visit her, and she would see as he was a very charming man.
Now, this was in the big cities of
all
the
over.
Soviet Union. Were there any painters working in Uzbekistan at the time?
Absolutely. And this is actually the biggest treasure of the Nukus collection because there were artists who were Russian who came to Uzbekistan to build the Bolshevik Revolution. And they came with these incredible ideas of European modernism and Russian avant-garde art. And for them, the Silk Road in Central Asia was like Tahiti for Gauguin. They fell in love with the colors and they mixed Islam and Sufism with what they brought with them from Europe.
Well, Islamic art is an abstract art tradition. Was Stalin trying to stamp that out as well? Or did he let people at least paint within that tradition if he was anti-religion, so I'm wondering just how much repression there was even in a place like Uzbekistan.
Well, it's incredible because Uzbekistan was the only place in the Soviet Union where the Bolsheviks were not able to eradicate Islam. The outburst against the Bolsheviks was so bloody that at some point they closed their eyes towards Islam and they let the Islamic art be.
Did some of these artists adopt the messages of socialist realism?
Oh, yes. Initially, that's what was important for us to show in the film, that this shift from the artwork when it was made in the 20s and 30s was a real celebration of the possibility of East meeting West and of, you know, a new utopia. But then when Stalin came in, when the repressions came in the 30s, they literally had to hide the paintings, stop painting. You know, if you were not painting socialist realist propaganda art, you didn't get artwork, art supplies.
One of the paintings in your film, by the way, we have made it available on a slideshow on our website at WNYC.org. It's called Fascism is Advancing.
Great story about that.
This is an incredible painting. This artist's works exist only in the Nukus Museum. And he was sent to mental hospital for these works.
They said he was crazy because he made those works?
He must have been crazy in their opinion, because only a degenerate person can paint crazy works like this that made no sense. And there were these incredible animals that he dreamt at night, and they all had eyes like the barrels of a gun. And he painted this incredible bull that we encourage everybody to see, that just stares at you with these vivid blue colors. And he called the painting The Bull, or fascism is advancing. And it was sort of a prophecy of what would come to the Soviet Union, all the repressions. He painted this in 1920, and shortly after that, the repressions followed, and he ended up in a mental hospital.
Yeah.
Now, were the painters who moved to Uzbekistan, were they safe? Were they able to do their work without having to worry about going to jail or going to a mental hospital?
Well, in the 20s and 30s, they were safe, and thereafter they were not. So successively, we have stories of, for instance, Kurzine, who he was the one wonderful story of his getting drunk and having his wife's panties on his head and you know, running around saying, let's attack the Kremlin. For that, there was this famous trial, and he ended up in the gulag.
And one of his friends, artist friends, was forced to snitch on him and tell that he's a very bad person and testify at the trial.
For other artists, it was either exile, like Kandinsky or Chagall. It was doing something else, like Tatlin, who started doing set design. Malevich, who was punished. Still, he tried to do realism for a while. Others wound up in the gulag.
Yeah. And some we
have— For making art.
Yeah, well, we have the story of Elena Korovai, the artist. She stopped painting, gave up, had a lot of emotional problems, and created these wonderful masks that you see in the film, and tried to sell them as just another way of making a living. The masks are incredible, but she could never sell them.
Savitsky died in 1984, so. He had already opened up this museum?
This museum was opened since 1966, and as we were saying, is the only museum that had forbidden art on display. For example—
Well, what 1966, that was Khrushchev, wasn't it?
Khrushchev.
And didn't he rail against modern art? Mm.
Absolutely, but Nukus was 1,700 miles away from Moscow, and the communist leaders there had no idea what modern art was. And the Nukus Museum was the only museum in the Soviet Union that had no artistic council of communist apparatchiks responsible to check the purity of the works.
Now, this film took you 6 years to complete. Why so long?
Well, you know, the collection does not have Malevich's. It does not have Chagall's. The people who left and went to Paris became famous. These artists were not known. The only paintings of Lysenko, like the bull, are in the Nukus Museum. And so the artists were not known. So the more famous, the more well-known foundations were not, you know, eager to step forward. We got modest support from the National Endowment for the Arts and from my university, from USC, and from Soros. But we'd get some money and we'd go over, then we'd have to spend time, raise money, come back.
We do have to give credit to New York City, because the first grant that enabled us to go to Uzbekistan was from New York, from CC ArtsLink Foundation.
You also got support from some of the people in the acting community, Ben Kingsley, mm-hmm. Sally Fields, Ed Asner, all did voiceovers. So what happened after Westerners discovered this treasure trove? Was there a feeding frenzy?
Stephen Kinzer, who was the bureau chief of Central Asia for New York Times, stumbled upon the collection in 1998. And as he says in the film, his jaw dropped when he saw that. And as soon as he wrote the front page article in the New York Times in the Sunday section, art dealers from all over the world started descending onto the Nukus Museum. And as Marinika said, they had bags of cash, Marinika, the director of the museum. And they had very good taste. They knew exactly which paintings are the best.
I'm assuming your film is going to make the situation even more intense.
Well, it does, because interestingly enough, in November, the collection is still endangered in a different way than it was when Savitsky rescued the paintings. But the collection is still at risk. The latest development is that for instance, the government has not made up their mind, the Uzbek government, whether they really want to wholeheartedly support this or not. And we had a preview at the National Gallery in which we wanted the director had permission. She had a U.S. air ticket. She had a visa. And the Uzbek government at the last minute forbade her to come.
Well, this is also an area of Islamic fundamentalism, isn't it? Would they appreciate this art any more than the Stalinists would?
Well, just to finish the subject, not only did they forbade Marianika to come to the U.S., but 1 month later, while she was away on business, they brought these trucks and buses and loaded all the paintings out of one of the buildings and transported it to the other building where it's actually staying in the hallways. And they scheduled the building for demolition. And the building had the restoration lab, storage facilities, and 2,000 works on display. And now this space is gone with no explanation or no, they don't say what will happen. How would the museum function? Which is incredibly shocking news to us.
Especially since this would be a major tourist attraction for a place that doesn't have much else to bring people to it.
As the director of the museum says, you know, this is the only treasure that we have. And, you know, we are hoping that our film will encourage the Uzbek government, the progressive forces, to embrace this collection as a tourist attraction. Right now, they only think of Samarkand and the Silk Road. They don't come up to the 21st century.
Well, maybe we need a Borat film about art. The Desert of Forbidden Art, made by Amanda Pope and Chavdar Gorgiev, is opening today at the Cinema Village, and I'm very pleased that they could stop by and talk about it with us.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.